times where the sun never shines. You'll shiver when the cold wind blows. There's a grave in the pine where the sun never shines. There's a grave that's shaded with a pine.
On the Slay Queens podcast, we take a deep dive into the dark side of the rainbow.
This isn't just a cheesy catchphrase. It is a note to remember that the topics we discuss can be very graphic and lurid in nature. Listener discretion has been advised.
Hey folks, before we get started, I just wanted to pop on and let everybody know that this episode is edited by your podcast editor.
Yes, and we love our editor, and you can start your own podcast and receive 2 edited episodes totally free. You can find him on Instagram at yourpodcastedit and save time and take your podcast to the next level.
Ooh, Slay Queen. Welcome back, everybody.
Welcome back,
queens, kings, and folks, here to the Slay Queens podcast, where we
do take a deep dive into the dark side of the rainbow.
That is correct. She is Ashley.
You are Wayne.
And we are here for another episode.
This is the Slay Queens podcast, throwing everybody off edition.
Throwing everybody off edition. The weird edition.
This is the weird edition.
And I mean, it's not wrong. It kind of tracks because this is a weird effing case that I have to talk about today.
No, it's definitely, there's some, weird.
Weird. I mean, it's really weird and frustrating.
Yeah.
Is kind of the best description. But
that makes for a good true crime case to talk about.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. You are not wrong. So welcome back, folks. We are the Slay Queens podcast, and we are about to do a thing that we do here because we are queer. We are going to offer you a rainbow star. Rainbow, again, because we're queer. Star, because we like to spotlight things. We like to thank people. We like to make acknowledgments or announcements, and we like to give people unsolicited recommendations.
That's exactly right.
Because it's our pasta.
It's our pasta, and we can eat it however we want.
Exactly. And it's also our podcast, and we can do what we want to.
That's right.
All right, Ashley. So am I kicking things off?
You are.
I think I am. Okay. We wanted to spotlight a fabulous queer-owned, queer-operated business, queer-friendly, queer merch, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can find their website with just a really quick, easy Google search of Music City Creative, or you can just find them at www.musiccitycreative.co. Or if Instagram is more your speed, because I basically find everything on Instagram
That's
these
our
days,
thing.
Or at least Google. They are Music City Creative Co. on Google. The sort of things that you might find. Personally, I now own a tank top that has the outline of Dolly Parton's face that just says
of
Queen.
Of course you
of
do.
Of course I do. We have a lovely Y'all Means All in rainbow.
I love that.
T-shirt. Hunter has that. And also an outline of Reuben McEntire's face on a T-shirt that says Fancy.
Of course it does.
Yes.
I love it. I love
it. Yes, yes, yes. So we highly recommend that. We want to spotlight that. Like I said, that's queer owned. That's queer operated. It's just queer friendly. It's queer, queer, queer
people.
We
love it.
And we love that. And it happens to be owned by a friend of mine. Hi, Steven. So we want to support them in all of their business ventures, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Okay. So does that officially mean we are now doing thank yous?
Thank you territory.
We are in thank you territory.
And who are we thanking?
We want to thank a couple of people who have reached out to us personally and individually to just give us praise and positive feedback. Yeah. About the podcast. Thank you to our friend Selena on Instagram, and also thank you to our friend Ivan on Instagram. Now, I don't want to give too much other information that can make them easily identifiable, but we do thank you so much for your kind words and your shout outs on social media and just the praise. It's literally those sorts of things that keep us doing this.
We love it. We do.
We do. It's so gratifying. And not that the work itself that we put into this podcast isn't gratifying, but it's just nice to know that people like and appreciate it.
Absolutely. Everyone loves a good compliment. Come on.
Everyone loves a good compliment. Okay, so are we acknowledging things now?
We are acknowledging things.
I didn't realize that I was really dominating this rainbow star.
But I'm here for it. This is your episode.
I apologize. Well, I mean, yeah,
I guess. Don't apologize. I like it.
Okay. So I would like to acknowledge the fact that though we try to be really positive representatives throughout the queer community for inclusion and just all things good, all things acceptance, all things love and learning in the LGBTQIA+++ community.
Namaste.
Yeah. We are not even perfect with regard to the way that we represent ourselves and the terminology that we use and et cetera, et cetera. So I'd like to acknowledge the fact that I was corrected this past weekend. I was spending some time with a very lovely non-binary individual and trying to be proactive with people who met this person. Mm-hmm. I would say things like, this is my friend so-and-so. They identify as non-binary. They prefer they, them, theirs pronouns. And my friend corrected me by saying, it's not a preference. This is
it
the
is
pronoun.
What it is, yes.
This is not how I identify. This is the gender. Mm-hmm. And at first, like I said, I mean, we try so hard to be these shining beacons, you know?
Right. We're doing everything right.
We're doing everything right. It took me aback for just a moment, but then I kind of had a moment where I was like, practice what you preach.
Absolutely.
Right? Practice what you preach. Normalize saying things like, thank you for correcting me.
I love that.
And I, yes. That's what I did.
It's hard
and
to do that.
It is hard to do that sometimes, especially when you maybe put yourself on a little bit of a pedestal.
That's fair. We
about
all do.
About being really good about that sort of
and
thing.
And we all do for certain aspects of our lives. It depends on what it is.
But I just like to acknowledge that it can happen to anybody.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I
and
do.
I'd like to acknowledge the fact that we should, I hate to use the term normal, but we end up using it a lot. We should normalize saying,
yes.
Thank you for correcting me.
I love that. Yeah.
So I'm officially going to let you.
And being okay with being corrected.
Absolutely. Being okay with being corrected, even if it takes you a moment. Because I'll be honest, it took me a moment. But even if it takes you a moment, don't speak out of confusion or frustration or out of ego.
Right.
Take your moment and go, okay, you know what? Thank you.
Yes. I appreciate being corrected because now I can better myself.
Absolutely.
Now I'm more knowledgeable and I can continue on being more knowledgeable.
Yeah. And we don't want to harm anyone, especially people in the queer community.
One of my favorite quotes that I try to go back to because I'm someone who does not enjoy confrontation.
Yeah.
Unless I've had too much whiskey. But one thing that I always go back to, I think it was a client of mine that said it years ago, and they said, Ashley, people don't know they're doing something wrong until you tell them. People will go on forever doing the same thing until somebody corrects them. And that happens so often where you just let people continue. Ignorance is bliss, right? Because we just don't want to tell them.
I say it all the time at work because I am very often responsible for training new employees.
Yeah, you are.
And I'm also often consulted in the training of employees that I'm not personally training, if that makes sense.
We'll what discuss should I do it. In this situation?
Exactly.
What would
people,
you do?
People will discuss with me, and I often say something to the effect of, well, even if you don't want to be the a-hole in this situation, you have to tell this person that there is a problem with regard to XYZ thing. Otherwise,
they're going
to
keep doing it.
They're going to keep doing it. People can't correct problems that they don't know they have.
Absolutely.
So
thanks for coming to our TED Talk. But that's a good point to be proven. Like, I like that. I like that we brought that up because it is hard to like swallow your pride in a way and be like, you know what? You're right. And I thank you for it. You know?
Yeah.
There's actually a book out there. I wish I should Google like who wrote it, but there's a book called, it's basically about like how using gratuitous terms like thank you, it can just better your life. You can literally chemically speaking in your brain, if you just say thank you more often or thank people for things that they've done, you physically will become a happier person because you're giving gratis to people, whatever it is, you're giving them credit and it makes it's like there's no selfless act, right?
Yeah. Well, and also it has to affect your world when you are literally putting like positivity.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Out.
You're putting yourself in like a happy mental state. Like, okay, maybe that didn't work out, but thank you for helping me with that. You know?
Thank you. I'm going to do
better. A happy spin. See, we're trying mental health awareness right here.
Yes.
Anyway, are we at the end? No, recommendations.
Recommendations.
And
I do, but I'd like for you to speak for a little bit.
I'm done talking right now. Oh, shoot. You know, this is a throwback, but we've been rewatching it. And I think I mentioned it on the last episode, but If you haven't watched it or it's been a while since you've watched it, I always recommend. I know I've recommended this before months, maybe years ago on the podcast, but 6 Feet Under. It's on HBO. It's a great damn show. Like, that show is so good. And I've watched it once all the way through before. And now that I'm rewatching it, Sierra, for the first time, I didn't realize how funny Frederico was, the cosmetologist, like the one who rebuilds them all.
Okay.
He's hysterical. Like, he's one of the best characters of them all. And I never noticed it until I'm like rewatching it again. You know what I mean? Not full, like, I'm just picking up on things I didn't notice before.
Well, that's the best thing, in my opinion, about going back and watching shows at like a different point in your life.
Yeah.
Like, you're a little bit different.
Yeah.
Your interests have changed a little bit. The things that you admire and appreciate have changed a little bit. So maybe you identify a little bit more with this character.
And I think maybe because like I've been talking a lot more recently about getting into what he does for a living. Maybe that's why I'm more like paying attention to his character specifically. Yeah. But he's freaking funny, man. Yeah. Like, he's a great character.
I like that show. I'm mostly just grateful for that show because that show was the whole reason I started watching Dexter.
That's so funny because mine was the opposite.
Oh, really?
And it's funny because I think that show came out way before Dexter did.
It did, yeah.
Yeah.
But I, of course, recognized the actor and I was like, oh, I really like him.
He's a great actor. He does a really good job at playing that guy that's like got a secret. Mm-hmm. He's very good at that. And even as like playing David in that show, I can see the similarities in like the character that he's playing, but he just does such a damn good job. Like, he's so emotional in that show. When he plays Dexter, there's no emotion. Yeah. I'm just so impressed by that.
Yeah, it shows a wide range
for him.
For an actor. What's his name? Michael Hall?
Michael C. Hall.
Michael C. Hall. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I thought. But I always confuse his name with that kid from the 80s who was part of the Brat Pack. Michael, whatever.
What was it?
Yeah, it was a similar
name.
It was a similar name. Yeah.
I love him. Even as David, even as Dexter, total crush. So yeah, I recommend that if y'all haven't watched it, but I need to know what your recommendation is.
Okay, so I think we talked about this a little bit last episode too, but I had a period of time where I was very sick, just allergies and like a bad summer cold, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I had plenty of downtime and I was fortunate in that downtime to find lots of good television to watch.
Yes.
And I really, really, really enjoyed the show Why Women Murder. Have you watched it
or know
anything about it?
I haven't watched it though. I wondered if it was good.
Okay. So the first season was fucking fantastic.
Okay.
Like, I just do not have enough good things to say. I love Lucy Liu. I love Jenny Goodwin. I loved all of the actors who I like just first became familiar with as, you know,
that's
I was
I think
watching
of in my head
that
is
season.
Jennifer Goodwin, that's what I think of, yeah.
So it was just such a fantastic show. Now, where I went wrong was that I was so excited about season one that I immediately jumped into season two. Season two is good, but it's different enough from season one that I'm harshly comparing the two.
I understand that.
And because I liked season one so much, I'm not enjoying season two as...
Because all you're doing is comparing it
exactly.
to not being as good.
And it's good.
Yeah.
It is good. I would recommend, though, that if anybody is going to take me up on this recommendation, give yourself some time between the two seasons, and I think you'll appreciate
that makes
each...
sense.
For what it is.
I can see that.
Like, individually.
Like normal people have to wait, you know, you see it and then you're like, okay, well, next season's coming out next year.
Exactly.
In 2 years or something.
And I think that's the way that it was designed, but because TV is the way that it is.
You can't stop.
And loved, don't have enough good things to say about season one. Season two is good. I just prefer season one.
Yeah, I can appreciate that.
So I think that's the end.
That's the beginning of the end.
The beginning of the end.
The end of the beginning, whatever it is.
All right. And
this story is, it really is.
Oh my God.
It's just bizarre. That's the good word.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
It really, really is. I feel like it's going to be a long one.
That's fine.
I purposefully tried to not make it a long one.
Sure.
So everybody, like, take a potty break.
Get ready.
Get a bottle of water or a glass of wine, maybe a snack.
Buckle up.
And then come back and listen to the story.
All right.
All right.
We are back again.
Exactly. We're making it as weird as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It suits the story. It totally does.
I didn't even do that on purpose, but you're right. Like, this is totally accurate for this episode.
Absolutely. So, folks, we today will be discussing the murder of Robert Eric Wan. There is not just a ton out there about this. I know a couple of other podcasts have covered it, but like it's not on a docuseries anywhere
sure,
that I'm
not
aware
like anything
of.
Big.
Yeah, so I feel like it's important for us to cover more of these kinds of cases, as in the ones that are lesser known, but maybe ones that are not this complicated, because, girl.
She had a time.
I did. I struggled with this.
And I started reading about this, and I was like, where do you start? Like, what do you even, how do you even, but you're so good at this. Like, you're really great at telling a story.
I hope it works out, because I swear to you, last night I was lying in bed going, I don't think my script makes sense.
No, I get that. I've been there before.
But let's see.
I'm sure it'll be great.
All right. So let's talk about my sources first. First and foremost, I used an arrest affidavit for one of the major players in this story that I found on legaltimes.typepad.com.
Oh, I love that.
And I will link to that in the show notes if anybody's interested, because I literally read it like word one to like word last.
I love that.
And it was really, really, really fascinating. Okay. Just too much information to put into this.
Yeah.
If you want to do a deeper dive. Exactly. Yeah. If you want to do a deeper dive. I also found a really amazing thread that I will also link to in the show notes on reddit.com, which was titled Sequence of Events of Robert Eric Wan Murder. And I got a little bit of information because, again, this is not a super, like, highly publicized case.
Yeah, no,
I couldn't find
all.
A lot of information about the victim prior to his being victimized. So I got a little bit of personal information about him from Wikipedia, the Wikipedia page,
sure.
The murder of Robert Eric Wan Wikipedia page, wikipedia.org. All right, so let's dive into this.
Let's do it.
All right, on August 2nd of 2006 at approximately 11:49 p.m., emergency services received a 911 call from 1509 Swan Street Northwest, which is a townhouse in the historic Logan Circle neighborhood of Washington, D.C. I do want to preface with the fact that the full audio of this call is actually available online. I think you can find it just on YouTube or just with a Google search. And I have listened to it, but I'm not going to play that here. I found it to be a little bit difficult to listen to, both because I'm super deaf and also...
I can't hear things anyway.
Yeah. Also, kind of socially, it was awkward.
Yeah.
And I say that because the 911 operator assumes that since she's speaking with someone who has a higher resonance to their voice, that the caller is female. So she continually refers to this person as ma'am, when in fact she was speaking to a cisgender homosexual man by the name of Victor Zaborski. So Victor is calling 911 to report he believes they've had an intruder in his home and that a house guest has been stabbed, that there is blood everywhere, and to please send an ambulance. So for a full 7 minutes, the 911 operator speaks to a distraught, crying Victor. And that's another reason why I couldn't really hear and understand.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to understand.
Because he's legitimately just like crying sobbing. And distraught and sobbing and whatnot. She's speaking to him, instructing him to apply pressure to the victim's wounds in attempts to help control the bleeding. When Victor explains that his partner is actually doing that, the operator asks him to make certain that the front door is unlocked for the first responders. Initially, Victor states that he's scared to do that. He's scared to go downstairs because they're unsure whether or not the intruder or the perpetrator is still inside the home, which is fair.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Like, I don't want to go it's traipsing around down yeah. there. I don't know who's here still.
But ultimately, he agrees to go down when he sees the lights, or the flashing lights, rather, of the police cars, the squad cars, and the ambulance outside. So
I'm safe now, kind
exactly.
of.
Exactly. If somebody tries to get me, the police will at least be close
They're
by.
Here.
Yeah. Paramedics first encounter what appeared to be a freshly showered Victor Zaborski, dressed in a crisp white bathrobe, on the front porch of his home, still on the phone with 911. When they asked to be directed to the victim, Victor did not respond to them. Rather, the two overhear him telling the dispatcher that the crime had taken place on the second floor, so they just made their way to that location.
Doesn't this whole, like, scene in your head just scream like American Psycho, though?
A little bit, but also I have been, as a paramedic, in these situations,
have you? Okay.
Or in situations like this so many times that I feel like I can see it just well normally, in my head. Yeah. Arriving to the second story of the Swan Street residence, paramedics encounter a man by the name of Dylan Ward. Dylan was actually exiting a bathroom and also appeared to be freshly showered, clad in a clean bathrobe. He did not speak to the first responders. When they asked for more details regarding the location of the victim, he simply pointed down the hallway toward a guest room, walked into his own bedroom, and closed the door.
So creepy, right?
Yeah. Now, that is creepy. That's creepy AF.
Yeah, AF.
Yes. Yeah. Upon entering the guest room, paramedics finally discovered the victim along with a third man. The man, Joseph Price, was seated on the edge of a folded-out couch bed with his back to the paramedics as they entered. He was facing the victim, but he was not touching the victim in any way. When questioned by emergency services as to what was going on, Joseph simply indicated they'd had an intruder, and while keeping his back to them, he stood and stepped sideways from the bed, which again, creepy.
Like, why are you sidestepping? Like, what is happening? Yeah. Guys, it feels like it's like choreographed in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like, don't make eye contact. You know, right? If I don't acknowledge them, they're not there. All right. So it was noted then that Joseph also appeared to have been freshly showered and was wearing only a clean pair of underwear, which is not so unusual if you're a gay man.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah. Spoiler. The victim, later identified as Robert Juan, was laying on his back, his head on a pillow at the top of the bed, and his body was slightly at an angle. Robert was on top of the bedding, which was perfectly made except for the top sheet and the comforter, which had been folded down at a 45-degree angle. You know how you do when you have house guests?
Yeah.
It's like a turn-down service.
Yes.
Yeah, like a turn-down service.
This is where you enter.
Exactly. Robert was dressed in clothing that he often wore to bed and also had his anti-teeth grinding mouth guard in, which he always wore when he slept. And those two bits of information were according to his wife later. Additionally, Robert was discovered to have three apparent stab wounds to the chest with little to no signs of blood loss. So why they said there was blood everywhere.
It's strange, right?
Yeah, really odd. Everything about this is just so odd. Despite the lack of bleeding from his wounds or blood throughout the crime scene in general, Robert was pulseless, he was not breathing, and he showed no signs of life. Paramedics did attempt to resuscitate him. They rushed him to the local trauma center. However, at 12:25 a.m. on now August 3rd of 2006, because it's after midnight, just 36 minutes after the 911 call was placed, Robert Juan was pronounced dead. So, who the F are these people?
Yeah, what is going on here?
How do they all fit into this story? Mm-hmm. And yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah, what the fuck? Just what the fuck? So this all might be a little bit hard to follow because there are a lot of names, there are a lot of moving parts, but I hope that I've broken it down to like the simplest form.
Absolutely.
So
I'm with you.
And then I've got a couple of moments where we'll just like recap to make sure that all the folks are on board as well. So, born June 1st of 1974, Robert Eric Juan was 32 years old at the time of his death. He was a fourth-generation Chinese-American born in Manhattan and raised in Brooklyn, New York. After graduating as valedictorian of his high school class, Robert went on to attend the College of William and Mary as a James Monroe Scholar. It was during his freshman year that Robert met and befriended an upperclassman, or a senior, by the name of Joseph Price. The two men had several shared interests and activities, including honor society and student government leadership positions. So sound like a couple of overachievers to me.
A little bit, right? Like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, this is William and Mary College. I mean, that's a big deal. My ex-brother-in-law, I guess you would call him, is a lawyer, and he went to William and Mary.
Okay, so it is a
big deal.
Yeah,
it's a big deal.
Okay, good for you.
Yeah. Though Joseph graduated in 1993, he and Robert remained good friends over the years. Robert himself graduated from William & Mary in 1993, and he went on to earn a law degree from the University of Pennsylvania Law School in 1999. During those same years, Joseph, so the friend, was establishing himself in a career as a lawyer, working for the prestigious law firm Arendt Fox, as well as the nonprofit LGBTQ+ advocacy group Equality Virginia. In 2001, Joseph Price met and began a romantic relationship with a man by the name of Victor Zaborski. So we're going to start hearing more names that sound familiar. Victor was a marketing manager for the Milk Processors Education Program, So AKA, he was one of the people responsible for the famous Got Milk campaign that was popular from about 1993 to 2014-ish.
Oh, it's like ingrained. It's like a special part of my brain that it's like in there forever. Yeah. I will never forget those.
Yeah. Basically, every celebrity who was anybody in
the 90s. Why are we looking at all of you with like a milk mustache?
Yeah.
Why is that a thing? How did it catch on like that?
And how?
Great marketing, clearly.
Yeah. And how was it like somehow sexy and sexualized?
With a milk mustache.
Yeah. All right. So they met and started dating. And then 2 years into their relationship, this is Joseph and Victor, Joseph begins having an additional sexual slash romantic relationship with a fellow by the name of Dylan Ward. So ultimately, Joseph and Victor agree to invite Dylan to be a permanent fixture in their relationship. So the men become a throuple or truple or triad or whatever terminology you use to describe a relationship between three people. Incidentally, that same year, so this would have been 2003, Eric marries a woman by the name of Kathy, whom he, by all accounts and all investigative findings, he loved, he was happy with, he was faithful to, and he did not stray from that marriage in any sort of way that anyone knew about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I didn't see it anywhere else, like that he was diddling on the side, I
exactly.
suppose.
All right, so let's recap all of that just to make sure everyone's on the same page and we know who's who and how they came to know each other. Robert Wan and Joseph Price met and became friends in college, a couple of overachievers. Joseph, who was homosexual, went on to become romantically involved with two men. The first was Victor Zaborski, and after that, they added a third whose name was Dylan Ward. Robert, who was not homosexual, met and happily married a woman by the name of Kathy. So that's it. Those are the major players in this story. And I've kind of purposefully left out a couple of other names just to make it less confusing.
It's cohesive this way. Yes. Yeah.
All right. So you're following at least. Okay. Cool.
You're doing a good job. We're good. So, we're good. We're all caught up. We know what's going on. All right. I love it.
So I hope the folks are following as well because that's actually the easy stuff to understand.
Right. There's a lot that goes on.
It's going to get far more complicated than that. Okay, so now we know who these people are. Now let's try and see if we can understand what led them all to 1509 Swan Street on August 2nd of 2006. All right, so first and foremost, in 2005, Joseph, Victor, and Dylan, who had all been living in the Capitol Hill area of D.C., active in the local gay community and such, purchased a $1.2 million three-story townhouse at 1509 Swan Street Northwest. And I don't actually have this in my notes, but I can't not say it. When I went to DC for Pride a few weeks back, we walked through this neighborhood.
That's wild.
Yeah, and I didn't even realize it until I was doing more research for the case.
Yeah, you're probably like, well, look at these gorgeous houses.
Yeah, I walked through Logan Circle.
That's wild.
Yep, yep, yep.
Serendipity.
Serendipitous. All right, so the property included a fully furnished basement unit, which served as a rental property to a female friend of the throuple. The street level first floor had a living room, dining room, kitchen, and a deadbolt door which led out into an outdoor, like, backyard patio area that was all enclosed by an 8-foot fence, and it was locked, like, with a gate. So, pretty difficult for anybody
to get. Yeah, pretty secure.
Pretty secure, exactly. Great word. Pretty secure. The second floor had Dylan Ward's bedroom at the top of the stairs. It had a bathroom and a guest room, which was primarily used as a study. I think they said it was Joseph's study, but it served as his study primarily and then a guest room whenever they needed it to. And immediately outside that room was a set of stairs that led to the third floor, which was the bedroom suite that was shared by Joseph Price and Victor Zaborski. So they were a throuple, but Joseph and Victor were married. And they shared a bedroom, and then Dylan was not married.
It was like extra.
Yeah, he had his own room. And we'll talk a little bit more about the nature of that relationship at some point in my notes.
It's around here somewhere.
It's around here somewhere.
We'll get there.
We'll get there. It should be noted that all the stairs throughout the home were uncarpeted, and they were wooden. So they were loud.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to say.
You hear everything.
Yeah. The house also had an alarm system that chimed every time the front or rear doors were opened. And we all know what that's like, right? We've all experienced our own home or someone else's home that does that. I'm sure we can kind of hear it in our own brains right now. And also put a pin in that or all of those details if you can. I know it's a lot.
Try to remember that.
Try to remember some of those details because they're going to kind of come back up in a little bit. So that was 2005. They move into this house and they're hosting brunches and being very merry and gay.
Merry and gay. Yeah. I love it.
In 2006, Robert Wan took a new job as general counsel of Radio Free Asia. As an Asian American himself, Robert was active within the Asian American community, supporting organizations such as Museum of Chinese in America, and actually serving as president-elect of the Asian Pacific American Bar Association. Again, just such an overachiever, right?
Jesus, I feel like I'm not doing enough.
During that time, Robert and Kathy, so Robert and his wife, were living in Oakton, Fairfax County, Virginia, which required that he make an approximate 47-minute one-way commute to and from work, so into D.C. on the metro.
I'm the one who's like, screw that, but I know that you do more than that when you drive to work.
Yeah, I do. It was for this reason that near the end of July, when Robert decided that he wanted to stay late one evening at work, he reached out to friends who had homes in the D.C. area to see if he could get a place to stay overnight. His purpose for staying late was going to be to attend a continuing legal education class on August the 2nd, and also to have the opportunity to meet some of the night shift employees at his new job, which I totally respect. He's like, hey, like, I want to get to know people. I'm new here. Like, I play a big role within this organization. I want to meet the people who I miss during my regular Monday through Friday 9 to 5.
Kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I've worked for people in positions of authority who didn't bother to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. That's not the norm.
Yeah. So I really appreciate that about him. He obviously cared about people, obviously took his job very seriously. All right. So at first, he reached out to a female friend asking if he could stay with her that night, but she was unable to accommodate him. And I'm sure there's a reason as to why. I just don't know what it was, but she wasn't able to accommodate him. So then he contacted his friend, Joseph Price, and asked the same. Joseph, of course, said yes. Robert said that he planned to arrive at about 11 p.m. that evening. Joseph agrees to this, and all respective partners, including Robert's wife, Kathy, were made aware of the plan. All right, so everyone's on board.
Everyone knows. We know what's going on.
Plan set. And I don't think anybody could have known
what the actual plan was about. I don't even know. Yeah.
We can talk about that maybe at the end, like what you think versus what I think, but let's just continue on with the story.
Yes, let's keep going. There's things that happen.
All right, let's talk about the day in question. On Wednesday, August 2nd of 2006, everything goes according to schedule, at least initially. Robert arrives on the metro into Washington, D.C. at approximately 8:45 a.m. His normal workday is pretty uneventful, and he attends the continuing education until about 9:30 p.m., when he calls his wife to tell her that the class has ended and he's headed back to work to meet the night shift staff. So that's all according to plan, right? All that information is actually verified by multiple witness accounts, you know, people in the class, video surveillance, phone records, witness accounts by employees that he met at work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now we're reaching the point of the story that the times and events become, let's just say, somewhat less verifiable.
A little bit sloppy.
A little bit sloppy, if you will. The following timeline is made up of mostly witness statements, and by mostly witness statements, I mean mostly statements from the throuple, okay?
Yes.
So at 10:24 p.m., Robert phones Joseph to say that he is finishing up at the office and he will be on his way to the Swan Street home shortly. The fastest Robert could have traveled to the townhouse would have been an 8-minute cab ride. I mean, he could have maybe walked, he could have taken the metro, but the absolute fastest he could have gotten there would have been an 8-minute cab ride. So the earliest he could have arrived at their house would have been 10:32 p.m. So according to Victor, he had already retired for the night and was in bed watching Project Runway like a good gay.
I love
when Robert made it to their home. Yeah, me too. Joseph and Dylan, however, say that they greeted Robert when he arrived and they chatted with him for a while over a glass of water in the kitchen until about 10:50 p.m. when everyone decided to call it a night. So per Victor, who's in bed, Joseph joined him for the end of Project Runway. And according to Dylan, he said that he had taken a sleeping pill and was in bed reading when he heard Robert showering down the hallway at around 11 p.m.
So you were in the shower.
So you were in the shower. And of course, just remember that Dylan's bedroom is on the second floor with the guest room and the bathroom that Robert would have used. He's just right down the hallway. So it kind of tracks.
Yeah, you can hear that.
Yeah, that he would have heard that. Then at 11:05 and 11:07 p.m., two emails were drafted on Robert's BlackBerry phone.
Oh, the BlackBerry.
Oh, the BlackBerry. Yeah. Did you have one?
Oh, yeah. I still have it. I don't use it, but I still have it because it's just sentimental.
I had one for work that I had to use because I was in a management position then, so I don't still have it. When I left that job, I had to give it back.
See, I used to get called out all the time on BBM, BlackBerry Messenger, because like there was no way to turn off. Like if you opened it, people knew. And I didn't know that at first. Yeah.
Okay.
I loved my BlackBerry though.
Oh, the technology. All right. So 11:05 and 11:07, he drafts two emails on his BlackBerry. One was to his wife, Kathy, stating that he had just showered and was about to go to sleep, which I found odd. Like, why wouldn't you call or text her?
Yeah.
Tell her that if it was really you.
That's a good point.
Yep. Another was confirming a work lunch with a colleague for the following day. However, neither email was sent, so the timestamps may have been unreliable or altered in some way.
That makes sense. Yeah, I read that, but I didn't think that hard about it. And now that you've mentioned...
I've had a lot of time. Yeah, I've had a lot of time to think about this. The neighbor whose house shared a wall with 1509 Swan Street later reported having heard what they described as a desperate scream from the home no earlier than 11 p.m. and no later than 11:30, as he was certain this happened while he was watching a specific news program. And of course, that news program aired between 11 and 11:30.
Sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. This scream seemingly went unnoticed by Joseph, Victor, and Dylan, who report being fast asleep in their respective rooms at the time. But a short while later, and I say a short while later because no one within the home could give an exact time, Joseph and Victor said that they were woken by the sound of the alarm system chiming, which of course was an indication that one of the doors to the outside had been opened, right? Which, for me, you didn't hear a scream, but you heard the door chime and that woke you up.
Honestly, like that, what? Yeah. I can't understand that. Yeah. Are you used to hearing screaming more than you're used to hearing a doorbell chime? Like, what is that?
If so, what kind of life do you live?
Right?
All right. So at first, the pair or the duo on the third floor, at first they thought nothing of this. They assumed that the downstairs tenant, so the basement tenant, was returning home, despite the fact that she had plans to stay out the entire evening and she had told them all that. So they thought, hey, she's an adult. Maybe she changed her mind. Maybe she actually did come home, which I will give them. That is totally fair.
Plans change. I used to listen to this. A little segue really quick.
Okay. No, please.
I used to date this girl whose dad, I might have told this story before a long, long time ago, but I love this. He would date different women. He liked blonde women. That was like his type, right? Fine. But he would never tell his kids, who were all grown at the time. They have their own kids. He's a grandfather. He would tell his kids that he was going out with plans. He would always call the girls he was dating plans. And finally, she got the courage to ask, mm-hmm. Why do you call them plans? Why don't you just say their names? He goes, because plans change.
Oh, okay.
I was like, all right, daddy.
I can
Silver
respect
Fox
that.
Over here. Okay.
I can respect that.
Anyway, plans change. So no, they changed.
That was good. Lighten up the mood just
yeah,
a little
exactly.
bit. Exactly.
Damn it.
Okay, so they hear the doorbell chime. It wakes them up. They don't think much of it. They just think their plans have changed of the downstairs tenant. But their suspicions were alerted when they heard a series of three grunting noises coming from the second floor. Joseph and Victor jumped out of bed and quickly descended the staircase to find Robert lying on the bed of their guest room, having been stabbed. It was at that time that they saw Dylan exiting his bedroom down the hallway to come join them. All three men denied seeing anyone else inside the residence. They denied hearing anyone run up or down the uncarpeted wooden stairs. And they denied hearing a second door chime, which of course would have indicated that someone had exited the home. And of course, despite there being unclear of exactly when all of this happened, we know that it had to have at least taken place before 11:49 p.m. because that's when the 911 call was made.
And I'm not going to lie, the whole time you're telling this story, I have this address pulled up on Google, like Street View, mm-hmm. like Google World. And yeah, this is the type of homes you look at and you just, they're historic homes. You know they've been refurbished. You know they've been taken care of. But you know as soon as you walk into that house, it's loud. Like yes. everyone's going to hear your footsteps.
Yeah, just stepping inside that home, the floorboards are going to creak.
Yes, that's how this house is.
Yeah. All right, so once again, that's the timeline slash version of events according to mostly witness testimony, aka mostly Joseph, Victor, and Dylan. Shall we now talk about the evidence and what that is indicative of?
Yes, please.
Yes.
Please do.
All right. Since we have access, or I had access to the arrest affidavit for one of the suspects, it's very detailed, like I said before, with regard to all of the investigation findings. And again, like I said, I'll link the full report in the show notes so that anybody who's interested can take a deep, deep dive. But for the purposes of just being good with our time management.
Concise.
Yeah. I'm only going to discuss what I feel are the most relevant findings. So let's start with the crime scene evidence. Police and ultimately homicide detectives began investigating the Swan Street home shortly after midnight on Thursday, August the 3rd. So they were not screwing around. Mm-mm. The first thing law enforcement took note of was the exact same thing that the paramedics had noticed, which was that all three men appeared to be freshly showered and wearing clean clothing. Next, they noticed that this high-end home, which was adorned with expensive furnishings and electronics, showed no sign anywhere of forced entry, and nothing appeared as though it had been disturbed.
Yeah,
nothing.
Right.
All right. Speaking of undisturbed, the room in which Robert Wan had seemingly died during a robbery turned murder showed no sign that that room had been ransacked or searched for valuables. Nothing of note was out of place, including Robert's wallet, his phone, and an expensive wristwatch that were laying out in plain sight for anybody who'd have entered the room.
Yeah, you mean to tell me that someone literally just tried to break in the house just to stab someone to death or murder someone and then just left and they didn't think, oh, look at that Rolly on his wallet. Like, you know what I mean? Like, no one, yeah, no, that's not real.
As a matter of fact, the only indications that a crime of any kind had taken place in the guest room were the following three things. The first, quote, two relatively small, well-defined spots of blood on the bedsheets, end quote. So two small, relatively defined blood stains on the bedsheets.
Yeah, like little, like a spatter.
Yeah.
Because if they're well-defined like that, it's just like a...
Yeah. All right.
That's the technical term for it.
Second was a large white cotton towel, which was found on the floor near the foot of the bed. Joseph Price would later allege that this was the towel that he had used to apply pressure to Robert's wounds as they had been directed by the 911 operator. However, since there were only a few small spots of blood on that towel, the largest of which measured 2.5 by 3 inches.
Not a chance.
Not a chance. This was later disproven by blood pattern experts.
I'm not even an expert, and I can tell you
exactly,
right now, bullshit.
Exactly. I'm a healthcare worker who's seen a lot of bleeding wounds,
right.
And no way, no how.
All right. Ma'am.
They suggested that the pattern of blood on the towel was actually more consistent with someone dipping a folded portion of that towel into a bloody wound and then wiping that blood onto another instrument, such as a knife.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which brings us to the third item found. Care to take a guess, Ashley?
Oh, what? No, you need to tell us.
A bloody knife.
Which makes, right? Hello.
Yeah.
We just set it up.
Yeah. A bloody kitchen knife from the downstairs kitchen of this home was recovered from the guest room nightstand.
It's just like the JonBenet a flashlight.
Exactly.
How did this get here? We don't know.
We don't know. We've never seen that before. Is this your pineapple? The knife measured 5.5 inches and had blood extending from the tip to the handle, the entire blade. Also, the blood on the knife contained, white fibers, which were a match to the towel that was recovered from the scene. But oddly enough, it contained no trace fibers matching the shirt Robert was wearing at the time of his death.
Okay, yes, putting this together, like, obvious. Okay, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I see where we're going here.
There were no other remarkable findings in the guest room. Other items that police felt may be relevant to this investigation were actually found in Dylan's room. It was there that they recovered BDSM literature and supplies, such as shackles, restraints, hoods, gags, vices, clamps, etc. And two things about that, just really quickly. One, I am not part of the BDSM community, but I know enough about it to know that true BDSM is not about inflicting violence on another person, and that consent is a very important component of that scene and of those activities. So it's kind of BS that they think these items are relevant to the investigation, minus one item that we're going to talk about in just a little bit. And yeah, it'll be clear which item we're talking about. And two, Dylan Ward had these items because the true nature of his relationship with Joseph Price, or because of the true nature of his relationship with Joseph, rather.
Which is not for them to judge.
It's not. It's absolutely not. So the two had a dom-sub relationship in which Dylan was the dom and Joseph was the sub. And as far as we know, Victor did not participate in those activities.
That was their thing.
Activities.
That was their thing. Exactly. And that's fine. Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that, like we were saying. We are not kink shaming, nor are we shaming the dynamics of anyone's romantic and or sexual relationships. Okay, so that being said, the one item recovered from these that I agree is very likely relevant to this investigation is an electronic male milking machine, which, for those who may not be familiar, is a device which can be placed on biological male genitalia. And electronic stimulation can then cause said genitalia to ejaculate. All right, so I know I keep saying it. There's just so much. Put a pin in that because it is going to be important down the line.
Yeah, it's a big point of contingency, yes, if you will.
Finally, found tucked away in Dylan's room, detectives discover a cutlery set which is missing a knife that measured 4 inches in length. And I've already done it once. I'll do it again. I'll say that again. A knife that measured 4 inches in length. And I don't know about you, Ashley, or any of the folks listening, but I mean, at this point, at least for me and my research and in the story, my inner, like, Trinity the Tuck Taylor was screaming, where is the blood?
Right.
I need to know, where is the blood? Right?
Yes. 100%. Like, why is it? It's just a knife.
Mm-hmm. And there's very little blood on him.
Anywhere.
There's very little blood.
Where is it?
Anywhere. Exactly. So they did bring in cadaver dogs because they also thought that there should be more blood.
I think of Dexter in the very first episode when he's like, no blood. It's the most beautiful thing ever. And I'm like, well, no, it's not. But like, also, where is it?
Exactly. Okay, so cadaver dogs alert to blood at exactly two other places throughout the whole property. They knew about the blood, like on the bed and in the guest room, but they only alerted on blood in two other places throughout the whole house, or the property even. The rear stairwell drain and the lint filter of the clothes dryer. Yeah. That's it.
Makes sense.
And they didn't even see blood. The cadaver dogs just smelled it there.
Yeah.
Exactly. And of note, the cover to the drain was ajar, and there was a backyard hose nearby that was uncoiled. But I don't find the uncoiled
what I'm hose picturing in my head that you could potentially do to a human body to drain it of its blood in that area with a hose. Like, that's what really creeps me out. Because I'm like, what exactly did you do? Yeah. And like, that's creepy. It's just an ominous, like, scene. It's just like, it's like when you go to the grocery store and you buy like random things and you feel like they're judging you based on what you're buying. It's kind of that, like where you walk in and you're like, what really went down here? Like, this is fucking weird, right?
Yeah.
It's odd. It's bizarre. It's whatever you want to call it.
It's bonkers.
Bonkers. Yes. Thank
you. Bonkers. All right. So that was just the crime scene evidence. We still have to talk about the body.
Yeah.
The autopsy, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So first, the paramedics reported that when they initially examined Robert Wan's body, not only was there very little visible blood, The body itself appeared to have been showered, redressed, and placed neatly on the bed. What the fuck?
Creepy crawly is all over. I feel weird.
The autopsy, which was performed on August 3rd of 2006, so again, they're not fucking around with this investigation, was conducted by the chief medical examiner for the District of Columbia, a person by the name of Dr. Lois Gosinowski?
Gosinowski,
who apparently had done 80 to 90 stabbing death autopsies prior to this one. So seasoned.
Yeah, very.
Bitch knew what she was talking about. Mm-hmm. And no, she wasn't the Dr. G medical examiner, but because I struggle with her last name, for the purposes of this podcast, that is exactly what I'm going to call her, Dr. G.
I love that.
All right. So Dr. G found that Robert had sustained 3, quote, remarkably clean, symmetrical, uniform stab wounds to his torso. Each was made with no defects, no drag marks, no abrasions, no fishtailing or the like. Each wound was inflicted at exactly the same angle, at relatively the same depth, and appeared to be methodically inflicted, end quote.
It's literally like a TV show. It's like a Dexter-like character.
Translation I have here, the stab wounds were inflicted by the same person, from the same position, with the same weapon, without any resistance or any fight from the victim.
Yeah, what kind of, were there drugs in his system? Okay.
We're going to talk about that in a minute. All right. The first wound pierced Robert's sternum and penetrated his heart at the aortic arch. So again, where is the blood?
That's literally your heart.
Like, you literally pierced this person's heart.
Yeah, that's like almost as bad as bashing them in the head.
Yeah, there should be so much blood. The second wound pierced his right chest wall near the 4th and 5th rib, penetrating his right lung. And then the final wound pierced the epigastric region. So that's the bottom part of the chest, the uppermost part of the abdomen. And it actually created a penetrating path through the diaphragm, small intestine, into the pancreas, which is a solid organ that bleeds a lot, and also hit the inferior vena cava, which is a large vessel that comes off of the heart.
Yeah, where's
Where
the blood?
Is the blood?
I can't handle it.
Yeah. This time we do get a tiny answer about where the blood is. Dr. G noted a significant amount of partially digested blood in Robert's intestine indicated that he was alive for a period of time after being stabbed. And again, translation, though he seemingly did not fight back or move at all as he was being murdered, Robert was not dead prior to being stabbed.
I need to know what drugs were in his system. I need to know. I don't remember. It's been a long time since I looked at this.
We're getting there. All right. So because of those findings, the stuff that we've talked about so far, his cause of death was determined to be the stab wounds. And the manner of death, of course, was ruled a homicide. A few more very important things were determined by Dr. G based on her autopsy findings. One, since Robert's wounds did not exceed a depth of 4 to 5 inches, it was unlikely that the knife recovered from the scene, you know, the one that was near his body, the one that was covered in his blood, the one that measured 5.5 inches. You remember that knife?
Yes, we do.
Okay. It was unlikely, damn near impossible, that that knife would have been the murder weapon. And it's far more likely that the knife missing from the cutlery set from Dylan's room was the actual instrument of death. Because, again, that knife only measured 4 inches.
That makes sense. So it was, like, cleaned off later.
Well, no. That knife was never located.
Oh, that's right, because it said it was missing. That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That knife was never located.
But it's also like, why would there be another knife covered in blood? Like, what's the point of that?
Well, it was planted, and obviously blood was placed on it by the towel.
With the
white towel fibers and the blood pattern.
These people don't watch enough forensic files.
They really don't.
Clearly.
Jesus. Yeah. Here's another thing. And you're going to like this one, because this answers some of your questions.
Yeah.
Dr. G observed several needle puncture marks to Robert's body. Marks on the left side of his neck, the top of his right foot, and the back of his left hand. She verified that these were pre-mortem, therefore they weren't a result of resuscitation attempts, right? So they weren't from like IV sticks or anything like that. From this, Dr. G determined that Robert had been chemically incapacitated prior to his attack, and that was why there was no indication that he fought his killer.
There's something so, there is like one of my biggest fears of like a way to die is like literally being incapacitated where you can feel and see what's happening, but you can't do anything about it. That's like, I've read like medical like diaries with like, you know, patients under the knife and all of that, where they like, they know everything that's going on and they can't communicate that it freaks me. Like, how twisted do you have to be to like really want someone to suffer like that?
Awfully.
Not that the doctors are doing it. I'm saying in this scenario, you know?
All right. So this is for you.
Yes.
It should be noted that a standard toxicology report was performed with negative results.
What the hell?
But should furthermore be noted that these do not test for a multitude of paralyzing and sedating agents.
I was going to say, forensic files taught me if you need to look for a certain drug, you have to look for that certain drug.
Exactly. So there could have been something there that they just didn't know to test for specifically. I mean, hell, it could even be ketamine.
Oh my God, I love that you said that because that's all I'm thinking this whole time is someone got a hold of animal tranquilizers.
It could easily be ketamine.
And just injected him all over the place with it. And that makes you unable to move.
Yeah. And that wouldn't show up in a standard like tox screen. Mm-hmm. You'd have to test for that specific.
I had this feeling that that's what it was.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, that's just my opinion.
We don't know, but I feel.
Yeah, I feel. And last but not least from The Good Doctor, and this is extra trigger warning for anybody who's maybe particularly sensitive to sexual assault, just skip ahead. Dr. G also collected samples using a standard rape kit. She swabbed his lips, his genitals, his inner thighs, his exterior anus, and his interior anus. On examination, all the swabs except the lips tested positive for semen, but the DNA of that semen was not found to be foreign to Robert Vaughn. So again, translation.
Got translation here.
The semen found on his genitals, his inner thighs, and inside him was his own.
And what does that make you think of from before?
That makes me think of the electronic male milking machine, which is why I think that is a relevant finding.
Totally.
In this case.
How else would you make that happen, really?
Yeah. And if anyone is...
And how perverse.
How ridiculous.
I've never heard of that before. And why would you... Why? Like, what makes you think to do something like that? Where is your head at? What's going on?
I have no idea.
Oh, I can't even fathom.
By no stretch of the imagination. And I felt the need to put this in here in case anybody's listening who's potentially confused as to how, even if this machine caused him to ejaculate, how that then ended up inside him.
Yeah.
I won't say any more than just this, but... In the gay male community, semen is highly fetishized, and it's often used as a lubricant for things.
I mean, even in a straight world community, I've seen plenty of pornos.
Yeah.
Like, that's,
so it's just FYI.
If you don't know now, you know. That's something that can be used.
Very possible.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I have heard people talk about this case, because like I said, a couple of other podcasts have discussed it, and they were heterosexual people. Or as far as I know,
they were
heterosexual people, and they were mind blown by that fact. Whereas I was like, I can totally see
that being used. Just like they're getting off doing this, basically, because they're using.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know about anybody else. I don't want to speak for other people.
Uncomfortable.
But like, my head is spinning.
Yes.
I have so many questions.
Oh yeah.
And I think at this point, all we can do is go, where's the solid ground that we can stand on?
Like, yes.
What do we know to be true?
Mm, right? I couldn't even imagine being the investigators in this case. Like, where do you even start? What the hell is this? What's happening here?
Yeah. These poor people. I hope that they got a promotion or a raise or
something
like a nice bonus.
A cookie, at least. I don't know.
I mean, a good chocolate chip cookie will make a lot of things better.
Right?
Not any of this, but a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Okay. Forensic and investigative science have told us what? That Robert Vaughn was incapacitated, that he was sexually assaulted, and that he was stabbed to death. That someone or someones, plural, put effort into covering up the real evidence while staging fake evidence.
Very poorly, I might add.
Very poorly. Also, there is and was no sign that anyone other than Joseph, Victor, Dylan, and Robert were inside the townhouse when these crimes were committed.
Yes.
These are the things that we can be sure of in
Absolutely.
This case. And spoiler, those are pretty much the only things
that we can be sure
that we can be sure of in this case. The things that science backs up, corroborates.
You can't disprove.
Yeah, you can't disprove those things. Okay, so the throuple, of course, was investigated. They were all cooperative with law enforcement. They provided multiple statements, fingerprints, hair samples, DNA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Each time they were questioned, whether it was individually or as a group, their stories perfectly aligned and never changed. We have no idea what happened. It must have been an intruder.
It's just wild.
That was their story, and they
stuck
to it.
Nobody cracked.
Nobody cracked.
It's just crazy.
The prevailing theory of the people who worked like the most on the case, the investigators who worked diligently mm-hmm. to try and figure out what happened, is that Dylan Ward, who of course was the closest, oftentimes we say this all the time, oftentimes the simplest explanation
yes.
is the explanation. Yeah. So Dylan Ward, in theory, was alone on the second floor with Robert Wan after everyone went to bed, right? So the theory is that Dylan drugged, assaulted, and murdered Robert, while then Joseph and Victor became accessories after the fact because he asked them to help him cover up this crime.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2008, they were actually all charged with conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and tampering with evidence, but ultimately found not guilty of those on June 29th of 2010, which is kind of bullshit. I mean, not kind of.
It's absolutely.
It's absolute bullshit, but.
Whoa, watch your step. You just walked into some bullshit.
But when I read the statement from the judge, I kind of understood why. It didn't make it better.
Where they're coming from.
But I understood where they were coming from. The judge stated that she believed that the intruder explanation was implausible, and she believed that all three men knew who had killed Robert Wan, but no single one of them could be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt based on the evidence they had available.
Basically, she's just admitting you guys were really good at covering up your evidence, whatever you did.
How?
Yeah.
That's my biggest mind fuck is they
How?
Had less than an hour.
I'm just, because it had to be, in my opinion, and we'll talk a little bit about it, yeah. right, at the end. In my opinion, it had to be planned by all of them. There was a monkey wrench of some kind, and that's why it ended up being not the perfect quote-unquote murder.
We'll talk about it. I have just sentences left, and yes. we'll talk about it. All right, so thus far, Robert and his family have received no criminal justice for his murder, but on August 3rd of 2011, and reading that right now, that was, what, 5 years to the day from when he was pronounced dead?
Yeah, yeah.
So, serendipitous. A civil suit was settled between his wife, Kathy, and the men for an undisclosed amount of money. Since then, the townhouse at 1509 Swan Street Northwest has been sold. It was actually sold at least a couple of times that I read about. And the men involved have changed their names and moved to different parts of the country.
I mean, I would too. And also, I will say, when you Google, like on Google Maps, like I've had pulled up this whole time, 1509 Swan Street, where it is, that's not what comes up. It's 1518 Swan Street. That address does not come up. So you have to kind of like, if you want to figure out what it is, zoom in real close because that's not what comes up. Isn't that weird?
Well, I mean,
I'm sure that happens a lot with certain like cases because I'm sure it's been like fetishized in a way or like, you know, negative things have happened. Like we talked about Bob Bordella house that like people would go and like pose at and stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
take photos.
There's always the few that like ruin it for the rest of us. You
absolutely.
Know, like I just wanted to see the damn house, but just judging the homes on the street. It's a very accurate description of, like, you know, affluent, but also a very nice old home.
Okay, now I've interjected a bit of it throughout the whole thing.
Right.
But now I think we can talk about what we think, what you
Our
think,
opinions.
What your theory is. And I would love to hear yours, actually, because I, of course, have been sitting in my own thought processes for a while.
I wonder, okay, so for me, like, I wonder if I'm just too far in, like, the cult realm of life right now. I get a very culty vibe from this whole thing.
Okay.
And not because they were in a throuple relationship or whatever, but just the fact that there was so many people involved, like so many moving parts, and then like nobody wanted to like talk about it. I just wonder if there was some underlying theme of like, this is going to be our sacrifice for some reason.
Yeah.
If that makes, or am I just like being totally off the wall, do you think?
I personally don't get that vibe from it, but.
That or someone got mad at him, like he did something that made somebody jealous and it was like, could have been just in the moment and it was premeditated, obviously. That's what I get, like definitely like premeditation. You don't just all of a sudden drug someone and stab them to death. Like, you have to think about that and come up with a good way to do it, right?
I agree with you that at least a portion of this crime was premeditated. There's no way they could have pulled it off with so little evidence.
Right.
Unless a portion
someone
of it.
Someone thought about it at some point.
Yeah.
My question, though, I just don't know, was it one person that had thought about this forever, executed it, and either A, it didn't work out exactly how they had thought and they had to recruit for help, or B, they didn't think it out all the way and they had to recruit for help? Or was this planned by all of them and they were like, you know, if we just stick together, dead man can't talk.
Yeah.
So we can just say, this is our story, we're sticking to it and nobody break. But that also, I don't know, it's just hard for me to believe that three people could be that involved with something and nobody says a word for, like, how long has it been now?
Even when they were arrested.
Exactly.
I mean, this happened in 2006.
Yeah,
so.
Like, it's been years and still nobody has said anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost August, so we're talking almost 15 full years.
I guess the more we talk about it, the more that I think about it, I think one person had to be the main, like, I need this person out of my life for whatever reason.
Yeah.
He's smarter than me. He's prettier than me. Whatever it is, I need them gone. And thought about how to do it, said, this is how it's going to go down. And these people are going to be forced to help me because they love me and they'll help me with anything. They told me they would do anything for me.
Yeah.
So they're going to help me after the fact.
Absolutely.
It
could
was too premeditated for me, though. It's just so weird. Like, it's ominous.
I agree with you on that count. So, in my mind, and I'm not even sure that I'm going to explain this as well as I should, but this is my opinion. Don't sue me. Don't sue Ashley. Don't sue us.
Opinions.
This is my opinion. So it seems to me that this crime had to have been planned and perpetrated by Joseph and Dylan.
Okay.
The reason I say that is because they, and this is not at all indicative of what the BDSM community is like, but we know that there are people within all communities who...
They could see maybe they're in that way. I don't know, in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe they weren't satisfied by the, I don't want to say restrictions, but like the general restrictions.
It was
kind of
like they were
community.
In that for the wrong reasons.
They were in it for the wrong reasons.
We've seen lots of
maybe
serial
they
killers
weren't,
that way.
Yeah, maybe they weren't so interested in consent.
Yeah. And it's an easy way to get someone in a vulnerable position that at first did give you some consent, and then you take it to a level that now they're compromised and there's nothing they can do. We've seen that happen multiple times.
I think those two men had an interest outside of the confines of consent with regard to the BDSM community.
They had like a conversation like, hey, I'd be into like taking this to the next level.
Exactly.
Their heads, which,
I think Joseph probably had a little crush on Robert for years because they had been friends for years. I think when the opportunity for Joseph to be in their home presented itself, that maybe one of the two or both said, hey, what do you think about...
Yeah, using him as a puppet, basically.
As a puppet. I think their plan was to drug him, to assault him, and to do it in such a way that he wouldn't remember. And
it was an accident that he actually passed.
See that. Well, we know that he was alive when he was stabbed, but did they know that he was still alive?
Yeah. Oh, okay, that makes sense,
too. When he passed.
I could see that,
Or maybe they didn't adequately sedate him enough, so they're like, oh, shit, now he's aware enough. Either they sedated him too much, they overdosed him, thought he was dead, or they under-sedated him, and Robert was like, I know what's going on. I'm awake and aware, and they freaked out and just stabbed him.
Yeah.
Right?
That's where I say, like, earlier when I said
There was premeditation. There was an idea of what was going to happen, but plans change.
Yes.
And a monkey wrench happened in some form or fashion. Yeah. And then they were like, oh shit, now we have to change our plans.
Yeah. I think an assault was planned by Joseph and Dylan. I think something went wrong with regard to the amount of sedation or incapacitation that they were giving him.
Yeah.
I think they freaked out for whatever reason. They were probably...
They're probably on drugs or something.
Probably on drugs or something. They probably had the knife handy because they were trying to inflict a certain amount of pain or at least fear.
At least have it in your hand because so
exactly.
you can be scared.
And then in that freaked out moment, someone killed him. And then I think they woke up Victor and said, this is what we've done. We need you to help us cover this up. I think the scream was Victor. When Victor came downstairs and saw what they had done, I think that was the scream that the neighbor heard. Because
that's actually a theory that I did read. I did read that theory.
Because he was distraught. He was upset. He was crying on the phone. So
and
why?
And he was the only one who was.
And he was the only one that was. Exactly.
Because there's so many articles out there, too, that I just like saw a couple little excerpts that were like, you know, all police report basically that everyone who was in that house was calm, cool, calm, collected, not even giving them directions on where to find a dead damn body. Like, they were just like, point. Yeah. Like, no conversation, no freaking out, no, not, that's a really, see, you're, if one of us were ever to actually be a detective, it's definitely you. I'm too emotional. I'm like, I've been watching a lot of cult things lately, so I think it's a cult. I have like a one-track mind when I get on something. But yeah. That really does make a lot. That tracks. That is a really legitimate theory, I think.
I am, if my theory holds any water, the thing that I'm still so just flabbergasted by is the fact that in less than 1 hour's time, they were able to cover up this crime so efficiently that there was not enough evidence to really prove that they had done anything wrong. And they stabbed this man in his heart.
Yeah.
How did they clean up that amount of blood?
Well, okay, so the point that was proven of, like, he obviously had been placed there, like, redressed and placed. I go back to that drain and that damn water hose thing. They could have somehow committed this act in that area, hosed him off after everything. And cleaned everything.
Yeah.
And that's where it drained out. Then they got him all cleaned up. I mean, God, was one of these people like an undertaker or something? Like, how did they come get... The thing that gets me is the stab wounds. How were they so precise? What did these men do for a living? Who, you know what I mean? Like, were you a butcher? Were you... well, they're rich. So I'm thinking, I don't know, like a plastic surgeon of some kind?
One of them's a lawyer. One of them worked for milk.
That's true. We do know what they did.
And
I mean,
Dylan, from what I understand, tried to be a children's book writer. He was a chef.
There we go.
There it is.
Yeah. You have to know how to use knife skills. There you go. Culinary skills.
Yeah.
But precisely, like, I couldn't do that. There's no way. Wow. I can hardly cut chicken.
I didn't. It was just, it was a tiny little snippet that I read just somewhere random. Yeah. But yeah.
Someone needs to put that together. Well, shit.
Did we solve it?
Story.
Legitimately.
Did we solve it?
Legitimately. This story, if I were going to do like a podcast that was just like a full season of one story, or if we were doing like live shows or something, this is a story that I could talk about for hours.
Oh, truly. Because there's so much more like information out there that I'm like, I want to throw this in here, but then we'll talk about it for 30 minutes. Like, I can't do that because it's going to be a forever long episode.
Yeah.
But like, it had been so long that I researched this when we talked about it, that I'm like, I feel like I'm hearing it for the first time again. Now I want to research more.
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes on.
There is a lot. And this was a lot of information, but not even everything that's available.
But I think you definitely told it in like a concise way of like, this is what we know. There's more information out there if you want to like put it together yourselves and try to like, you know, solve this shit. Paul Holes and Billy Jensen really need to cover this case because it needs to be solved.
It really does. It really does. And yeah, I mean, like I said, I could talk about this for hours, but I feel like we have to draw a line in the sand.
We need to go call up our girl, Bad Bitch Yolanda.
BBY.
She's got to cover this case, man.
Yes. BBY, if you're listening, she followed our Twitter.
Ah, oh, I love that. That made me like...
She followed our Twitter.
That's like a moment of starstruckness. I'm like, yes, honey. We'll tag her. We love you.
We do love you. We love you, BBY.
Yeah.
Okay. We love all of you folks, actually.
Yes. Thank you for hanging out and sticking it in there. Yeah. Sticking it in there. Ooh. Sticking it out.
Sticking it out there with us.
Yeah. It's a story. It's a real story.
This is a bit of a long one, but we thank you for listening. And if I'm really intrigued, if anybody wants to reach out and let us know what they think.
Yeah.
Something that we've not considered, because it is really easy to get kind of tunnel visioned with your own theory when you just get on that track.
That's very true. Because I kept having this culty vibe, and that's, again, just because that's where my head's been at. But then when you tell me yours, I'm like, oh shit, like all of that tracks. And then someone else could have something completely from left field. That's what the Forensic Files does. You know, they always set those shows up. I'm finally almost done with all 15 seasons.
Really?
But I swear every episode it's like, oh, that's who it is. Nope, that's not who it is, because that'd be too easy. It has to be something really complicated. And then half the time it's like, no, it goes right back to that.
To the most simple explanation.
Yes. They always put you on that loop, though. So I want to see what other people's, where's your loop going?
Is your loop going? Yeah. If you are thinking something, if you agree with either of us, or you're thinking something completely out of the box.
Or if you're thinking that someone else really did do it, maybe they entered without forced entry.
Yeah.
Who else could be involved?
It's possible. You know? I mean...
At this point, anything's possible, but I think yours makes the most sense.
Yeah. Okay, so you can reach out to us with that information or love and praises and all sorts of good stuff.
Yes.
Where can they find us?
SlayQueensPod@gmail.com, on Twitter, on Instagram. Go join our Patreon.
Go join our Patreon. You're going to get episodes early, and you're going to get a bonus episode every month.
Yes. Oh, and website and merch to come. We're still working.
Definitely. We're still working on that, but it's been difficult to commission artists because everybody's having difficulty hiring people to do all sorts
of everything. Yeah. That's where we're at right now.
Yeah, but we're trying.
Yes.
So we love you folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we hope that you would...
Go out and slay, queens.
Go out and slay just...
Just not each other.
Not each other.
And we're going to leave this room so we can stop sweating. Love you. Bye.
Bye.
I'm going away, but I won't come back on a lonesome railroad line. But I can't forget that sweet little girl who sleeps in the pines.